Good afternoon, everyone. I don't know whether it's morning, afternoon, or night. I just know that I have been behind this podium longer than anybody ought to ever do. But here we are again. I was upstairs laid down for about 20 minutes, and I actually thought I was standing behind the podium instead of laying in the bed. I don't want to do a victory lap too soon, but we've got just one chapter to go. Goodness gracious. Wow. So here we go. You guys have filled us in on things that you've learned through this. I think a lot of the intricacies of the Greek has been very fascinating for many of you to find out what these prepositions actually mean. Who would ever known what's in a preposition? You know, even in our language, in, out, on, over, it's very important. You know, it tells you much about the story. And in the Greek, it's vitally important that we know those. These words have been homogenized by them being translated into the English, and we've lost their meanings through translation. I'm not real sure why someone thought, oh, well, let's just call it this, when this is not what it is. It really is quite obvious to even the layman that these things have not been translated correctly. One cannot help but think that they have been translated with bias. Is the reason that the prepositions and different things have been translated the way they have. It supports the doctrine of having to believe in Christ to translate the word ek out of as in. And when you do that, it does change this. So was there a choice, was there a persuasion that this is what faith was? Yes, and that's what we've been studying, is that Paul was up against the Word of Faith movement. I really like saying that for some reason, because that's what he called it. The only place in the Bible that talks about the Word of Faith is in this teaching, which we just finished up chapter 10, and Paul was saying that people are dealing with a doctrine that says that salvation comes by believing in your heart and confessing with your mouth. Well, if that's true, then why didn't they just get saved before the cross? If just believing in your heart and confessing with your mouth was the power of God. If the gospel is the power of God, why isn't it stated that believing in your heart and confessing with your mouth is the power of God? That statement is not made. Because the gospel is the gospel of peace. The gospel is good news, not good instructions. All right? If it's not good news, if it's an instruction, it's not the gospel. Folks, it's just that simple. If you have to believe in your heart and confess with your mouth, that is not good news. That may be a good instruction if it's accurate instruction, but whether it is accurate or not, the fact that it's an instruction of something you have to do is not good news. That's no longer news. It is information. It is an instruction of something that has to be done. The gospel of peace, according to Paul, is that which is already settled forever in heaven and in earth, that heaven and earth have come together as one thing, and that God and man has now become just one thing. We live in a time that we ought to be so excited about. Instead, Christianity and other religions around the world have us paralyzed looking for the end of the world. You're not living in a world that is going to be ending at the hand of the wrath of God or a end-time prophecy that has not been fulfilled. There is no such thing as a prophecy that has not been fulfilled out of the Scriptures. It does not exist. Jesus came as the fulfillment of all things. Paul made it very clear, and he is in all, of all, through all, to all. Talk about preposition, 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 preposition. He's in everything. He is positioned in every possible way with the human race. that you can't get away from Christ. When you look at somebody, you see Christ. That is Christ that you are looking at. When you look in the mirror, you see Christ. Once this concept finally settles in our hearts and our minds, then we'll be able to see the world in a different way. But you cannot ignore the fact that Christianity has given the entire planet this apocalyptic view of the world instead of a hopeful situation where that things are getting better. It is really odd that even in the middle of the end is coming soon, the end is coming soon, the end is coming soon for 2,000 freaking years, we've still made progress in spite of them. It has never been because of them. Now, there are a lot of really good Christian people that have done some of these things that have led us forward. But folks, I'm not going to let the kindness and goodness of some Christian people sell me on the fact that their Christianity has any value whatsoever. I'm not going to do it. I can acknowledge there's good Christian people. You know, one of my relatives said to me several months ago or a year or two ago, she was all down about Muslims. And she said, you know, she said, they're trying to say that there's some good Muslims. She said, I just don't think there is any. And I said, well, I said, hun, you know what? I'm really radical. I'm pretty radical. I actually believe there's some good Christians in this world. There's a few out there. There's a few really good Christian people. Just the same as Islam is not what makes those people good that are good, the same is Christianity doesn't make good Christians that are good what they are. Buddhists, that's not their Buddhism that makes them good people. It is their Buddhism that they are good people in spite of their religion. So just because you see somebody that has some stability in their life, you see it may be in spite of their religion instead of because of their religion that they have something good going on in their life. We have, how many of you can tell we're not dancing around the subject anymore? We're just not dancing around the subject anymore. The older I get, I realize the less time I have, and I realize I got to say this strong, I got to say it fast, and I got to say it good, I got to say it right, and when I'm wrong, I got to say I'm wrong really quick so that we can go on to something else, so that we can get this gospel out to the world. We're standing in a position to where that this powerful gospel can make the major change in what this the way this world is functioning. In a very powerful way. I'm totally convinced of that. You say, well, what if we are all completely wrong? You know, think about that just a minute. It's healthy to stop and think, what if you're really wrong? Do you know that even if you're wrong, that based on Christian doctrine, you're still saved? You're still saved even based on Christian doctrine. If everything you've learned in the gospel revolution is wrong, has anybody convinced you here that Jesus Christ is not Lord? Anybody here ever convinced you that Jesus did not come and his life was introduced into this world through a virgin? Did anybody ever try to convince you that Jesus didn't die on the cross for the sin of the world, that he didn't raise from the dead on the third day? Has anybody ever tried to convince you of that in the gospel revolution? Nobody's ever. In fact, we actually think we know that better than we did when we were Christians because we understand why it had to be that way. That's why I say it's my situation is I really don't believe in Christ. I know Christ. I tell you, once you learn the facts about why and how all of this takes place, you go from a believing state to a knowing state. And I'm always looking at the situation with Paul. If Paul claimed that to know Christ, it's like, okay, Paul, if you can know Christ, I can know Christ too. It's just like Paul getting, I got upset with Paul saying that he was redeemed by the faith of the Son of God. Why is it I got to use my faith? And Paul, you said you got redeemed by the faith of the Son of God. If Paul can have it, I can have it. If Paul can see it in a more positive way, then I can see it in a more positive way. After all, he wrote 3/4 of the New Testament. So the book of Romans, as we've learned, Paul is reaching into the apostles' chambers. Paul is reaching into their works. Paul is reaching into that place that he described in the book of Galatians, where that they had, were not walking uprightly according to truth. Paul was reaching into, this is not a church that Paul established. This is a church that Peter established. Paul, there is no record of Paul having anything to do with the establishment of this church at Rome. And Paul is reaching in, trying to persuade them of something other than, in fact, said, remember early in the chapter, of the first chapter, he said that they needed to be evangelized to the gospel. They had never heard the gospel. That's what Paul said to these people who are emphasizing faith as the thing. Faith is it. Paul saying, man, your faith is heard throughout the entire cosmos. And these same people, according to the way Paul said this, because these Greek words are very emphatic, what Paul said he was going to do was going to go and evangelize them. Now, he said they're already saints. Everybody there is already saints. Every one of you are just as much a saint as me. He told them, he said, all of you here are apostles just as much as I am. But you've never, ever been evangelized by the gospel. So I'm going to come over there. Now, he also said, there's been somebody that has been hindering me. They've been fighting me about coming there. When you look at the history of this, you begin to realize this open history, not hidden, secret, you know, deep, dark back waters thing that you have to try to kind of dig up and make up on your own. It's point blank here. It's Acts 15, it's Acts 21, it's the book of Galatians. It's all the way through of the statements that they've made about each other and their disagreements. Paul being accused of a freedom that is so radical that they're saying that Paul's out saying that we should go out and commit sin just so that grace can abound. Paul, even Peter said, them things that Paul teaches, man, they're very weighty and hard to be understood. Now, why would they have been weighty and hard to be understood? Because they totally disagreed with what Peter, James, and John taught. That's why it was weighty and hard to be understood. That's why it seems weighty and hard to understand for us. Because you and I learned what Peter, James, and John said the gospel was. Even though 3/4 of the New Testament was written by Paul, we got converted to Peter, James, and John's gospel, which Paul said is not a gospel at all. And we didn't hear the gospel at all either until we were well saturated into, many of us, the Word of Faith movement. We never knew. We never knew that Jesus Christ had accomplished all of this by himself in an agreement that was carried out between he and the Father, that was agreed upon and settled on before God created the very place that we live. It's an ironclad deal, folks. It is powerful. Are we still learning? Are there things that we don't know? I'm very glad to tell you I still don't know it all. I think when I take my last breath on the face of this earth, I still will not know it all. But we depend on others to keep learning after us. What we've got to do is pass this on in a solid enough foundation to where that people will be able to start from where we leave off. Not to say this, that's why, you know, some people are wondering, why are you getting so strong in the language that you use, Mike? Because I realize we can't keep playing around. We can't be playing with people's sensitivities and at the sacrifice of getting the point across of the truth of the gospel. You guys know here, I'm as sensitive to as anybody could be for people's feelings and how they feel. I don't want anybody to feel put upon. I don't want anybody to feel in any negative way whatsoever. I go out of my way to help people around me feel good. And but the fact of it is, when it comes to the gospel, folks, we can't let those things be swaying us. There's something more important that is in at play here. It's called the truth of the gospel. It's called the evangelizing of the whole world to the gospel that Paul was laying out for us in opposition to Peter, James, and John. Chapter 11, I say then, hath God cast away his people? God forbid. Now Paul begins to deal with the Gentiles. He's gone back and forth. The Jews didn't believe the Gentiles were saved. The Gentiles didn't believe the Jews were saved. For different and varying reasons, they doubted the salvation of the other. Now, Paul is now talking to them. Remember, he started out, says, oh man, you know, I really wish that Israel could be saved. Man, I'd give anything. I'd almost wish that I was accursed from Christ for the sake of my brethren, that they could be saved also. Now, it's a strange statement on its face based on what 9 chapters before that have said. Much less what it says in chapter 10 and chapter 11 that affirms that Paul is saying something here that is not something that Paul teaches or even agrees, nor does he support the statement he's making himself. So he's asking them, has God cast away his people, the Jewish people? God forbid. For I am an Israelite of the seed of Abraham, of the tribe of Benjamin. God hath not cast away his people, which he foreknew. Now there's the word foreknowledge. Now what did Paul say in the Romans chapter 8? For whom he, well, let's go back. Let's connect this chapter to the whole book. So now he's talking about the Jews, right? God has not cast away the people that he foreknew. Now let's read through chapter 8, verse 29. For whom he did foreknow, he did also predestinate to become, to be conformed to the image of his son, that he might be the firstborn among many brethren. Moreover, whom he did predestinate, and who he foreknew, he predestinated. And those that he predestinated, them he also called. And whom he called, them he also justified. Do you see that Paul's feigning concern for Israel? It's obvious. He called them also, and he justified them. And whoever he justified, he also glorified. Paul's already taught that Israel has been completely glorified in Christ. Paul's not concerned about their salvation. He's used the term here, predestined or foreknown, and he used this in chapter 8. Won't ye not what the scripture saith of Elias, how he maketh intercession to God against Israel? Now here was a man that was making intercession against Israel. Lord, they have killed thy prophets, they've digged down thine altars, and I am left alone, and they seek my life. But what saith the answer to God to this man at that time? I have reserved to myself 7,000 men who have not bowed the knee to the image of Baal. Do you know how many Christian groups have started out believing that their group was the 7,000 that God had reserved to himself that have not bowed the knee to Baal? To bring that out of here, when this was spoken probably 3,000 years before to a specific man about a specific situation, and God said, I've reserved 7,000 men who have not bowed their knee to the image of Baal. We don't even have an image of Baal around anymore. Even so. Now, so he said that for a purpose. So here was this prophet that was prophesying against Israel. God said to him, don't worry about it. I have exactly 7,000 that have not bowed their knee to Baal. So we're going to get through this. God had them all checked. God had them all named. And he said that I have 7,000 that have not bowed the knee to Baal. Even so then. Now, you see, that was a historical point that is being referred to. This is not about now. We're not looking for 7,000 people that have not bowed their knee to Baal. And churches really have started on this. I mean, there's churches that started on the 144,000. The Jehovah Witness did. Man, there's going to be 100. Then they had a problem. They got more than 144,000. So then they changed it from that to 144,000 priests. Then they got more than 144,000 priests, and then it had to become subdivided to something else. You know, it's amazing when your prophecies have to be altered to accommodate your beliefs. Anybody that is trying to say this 7,000 is a prophecy unfulfilled, it is just ignorance, and there's nothing more or less that can be said about. Even so, at this time also, there is a remnant according to the election of grace. He said that back in chapter 8 also, right? And the remnant was a who? It was not 7,000, was it? It was one, because a remnant can be as few as one. And this is exactly what he was saying, was that this remnant was there in place. Even so then, at this present time, there is a remnant according to the election of grace. And if by grace, then it is no more works. If it is grace, it has how much to do with works? Nothing to do with works. Now, just in case that isn't understandable, otherwise, grace is no more grace. So grace ceases to be grace when what comes in? When works comes in, grace is non-existent. But if it be of works, then it is no more grace. Paul must have known these people were having a hard time getting the concept of grace and works. He goes on, otherwise, work is no more work. If grace is grace, it doesn't have works. If it has works, then it's no more grace. And if it's grace, then there's no such thing as works. Otherwise, works is no longer works. Man, I tell you, I get so tickled when I read this. I mean, it's like Paul is just taking this and just shoving it into their brain. Don't you get it? If works are involved, there's no such thing as grace. James, did you get it? No, he never did. Sorry, James never got it. James was absolutely convinced that it was by faith and by works that there was justification. He made it very clear. What then? Israel hath not obtained that which he seeketh for, but the election has obtained it, and the rest were blinded. You see, in fact, the election obtained it while they were all blinded. Everyone was blinded by the law because of this term suncleo. This is just the way this has always gone. God didn't just pick a few to put under the law. He didn't pick a few to blind. He blinded everybody because there was a powerful work that was going on that would have nothing to do with mankind, that would set us in a position that is so unique, so powerful, that all it takes is knowing about it to revolutionize people's lives and life on planet Earth, just by knowing about it. And by knowing about it, it means there's nothing you can do about it. If there's nothing you can do about it, then it has nothing to do with your works. Else works, grace becomes something you do about it. Otherwise, something you do about it becomes no more grace. So grace becomes something that there's nothing you can do about it. Israel didn't obtain it, but they got it. They didn't obtain it, but they got it. So what is this heartfelt plea from Paul? Oh, my heart's desire and prayer to God is that Israel would be saved. Now he's explaining they didn't obtain it, but they got it. According as it is written, God hath given them the spirit of slumber, eyes that they should not see, and ears that they should not hear. And then he says, unto this day. Remember when he said in speaking to them in Corinthians, he said that the veil from Moses can still be over these people's eyes, to where that if they are still trusting in the law, they're not going to be able to see grace. That very same thing can be said to Christians. The law is a blinding factor. It blinds. And David said, now, remember when we started chapter 10, or the end of chapter 9, and we read, "Behold, I lay in Zion a stumbling block, a rock of offense, a stone of stumbling." Yeah. Remember we read that? So, was that a little bit hard for your head to go kind of like this? Because we've always been taught that Jesus was the stumbling stone and the rock of offense. Well, let's read a little bit further then. And David said, "Let their table be made a snare and a trap and a stumbling block and a recompense unto them." Now, do you have any doubt as to what the stumbling block was? It was their laws, their feast days, the tabernacle, the temple, everything became, the very thing that God laid out became the stumbling block and the stumbling stone for them. To what degree? "Let their eyes be darkened that they may not see and bow down their back always. I say then, have they stumbled that they should not fall, that they should fall? God forbid." Did they trip over the stumbling stone that there would be no recovery for them? No, they were supposed to trip over the stumbling stone. They were supposed to get tripped up by the law. But rather through their fall, and how did they fall? They fell how? By tripping over the law. Salvation is coming to the Gentiles. So while the Jews were still feverishly working toward becoming righteous through the law, suddenly the Gentiles come in. What a shock. Now the problem was that the Gentiles thought that they got in because of their belief. This is what Paul's going to address throughout the rest of this chapter, is the fallacy of personal faith getting you saved. Folks, we're not here to discount personal faith and a belief in your own heart. We're here to challenge, or let Paul challenge for you, what it actually does and what it actually does not do. It's vitally important to know what your beliefs can accomplish and what your beliefs cannot accomplish. Because if you think your beliefs can accomplish salvation and redemption for you, you are in a cult. You are in an antichrist cult, because the emphasis has been taken off of Jesus and has been placed on you. It has been taken off of his obedience. It has been taken off of his righteousness. It has been taken off of his faith, and it has been placed on your faith, your righteousness, and your disobedience. What is that, Michael? To the gospel of Jesus Christ, that is cultish. But rather through the fall, salvation has come unto the Gentiles for to provoke them to jealousy. Now, if the fall of them be the riches of the world, they fell. Were they utterly cut off? No, they weren't cut off. They stumbled. They fell as they were supposed to do. By them stumbling and falling over the law, it gives another understanding of the possibility that Gentiles could be included in this. Now, part of this is Peter's fault. This church was established by Peter. Let me tell you what Peter went back to this church and told them. Jesus appeared to him and let down a sheet from heaven with all manner of four-footed beast in it, and said and told him to rise, kill, and eat. Peter said, "I'm not doing it, Jesus." Again, Jesus said, "Peter, rise, kill, and eat." "I refuse to, Jesus Christ, Son of God, risen Savior. I refuse to obey you." The third time, Jesus says to him, "Peter, rise, kill, and eat." I wish he'd have said, "Rise, kill, and eat, for I kill you." But a gospel of peace had already been declared. Sorry, I got a little judgment left in my heart still. Peter got a revelation of the redemption of the whole world. So he goes back to these people, and you know what he says to them? "I've got some incredible news. Man, I'm telling you, Jesus himself has appeared to me. And you know what he told me? He told me that even the Gentiles can be saved. Now, it seems as though Peter was a little bit ADD. Everything that Jesus ever told him, he had to tell him three times. It's like, wake up, Peter, did you hear what I just said? Well, let me tell you again. Peter, feed my sheep. Huh? I said, feed my sheep. What do you mean? Feed my sheep. That's what I meant. Peter. Hey, Peter, do you love me? Well, of course I love you. Hey, Peter, do you love me? Yes, Lord, I love you. Peter, do you love me? And each time Peter responded with a different word than what Jesus asked him. Jesus was asking him if he agape'd him. And he responded with words that were lower level of love. Filio. Yes, I filio you. Yes, I and one that is means brother. I have a familial love for you. No, Peter, I ask if you agape me. Every time that Jesus ever spoke to Peter, he had to tell him three times. And even when he got told him three times, he still, in this case, did not get the message correct. And went back and told them something that has held the entire Christian world in bondage ever since that misinterpretation, misquoting Jesus after he said the Gentiles can be saved. Just think what would have happened if Peter would have come back with what Jesus told him. Guess what? All Gentiles have been cleansed. They're all saved. What would they have figured out about the Jews? Well, dear God, if the Gentiles got it, then we surely are in there, right? But that wasn't the message that this man, Peter, brought back. It was a possibility message. It was a can-be message. It was a can-do message, not a God-did message. Now, if the fall of them be the riches of the world, and the diminishing of them the riches of the Gentiles, how much more their fullness? Now, he's having to present this to them in a possibility mode because that's where they're trapped in their thinking. But watch how Paul takes this, this doctrine that Paul taught them, that the Gentiles can be saved and the possibility of Jews being saved, and watch Paul begin to whittle that down to where that it is absolutely wood, hay, and straw. Verse 13, for I speak to you Gentiles, inasmuch as I am the apostle of the Gentiles, I magnify my office. Now, I think that Paul was saying this because, you know, if you go back and read the story, Jesus didn't call Paul to the Gentiles. Jesus called Paul to the Jews and to the Gentiles. Made it very clear in the book of Acts. This was a political settlement. This is how these guys were to get along. Okay, you go to the Gentiles and we'll go to the Jews. Because the last thing we can have is you running around telling Jews that they're not under the law, that they don't have to be circumcised. If you're going to tell people that bullshit, you're going to tell it to Gentiles, not to Jewish people. They called him in on the carpet two times. For that very reason. Do you know that James came up with the solution for Paul in teaching not Jewish people but Gentiles? Do you know that he gave them three of four laws that Paul was told to have to preach? He gave them three laws that had nothing to do with anything except Jewish custom. Abstain from things strangled. Abstain from blood. He gave them only instructions. The only one he gave them that was any moral base was, stay away from fornication. Everything else was nothing but a Jewish custom. That's all it was. And he said, you've got to keep these. You've got to tell the Gentiles they've got to keep these Jewish customs. Why? Loss of control, that's why. They've got to keep these. You've got to tell them they've got to keep these. Now, not only did they tell him, they so did not trust Paul. They wrote all this stuff down in a letter and sent two men with him to stand up and read this letter about what the Gentiles had to do to be saved in all of Paul's meetings from there forward. They didn't just say, now, Paul, this is what you need to tell these folks. They said, here are two men that we are sending with this letter, and they are going to inform the people that you preach to that this is our decision. You think there weren't politics involved in all this? I magnify my office. If by any means I may provoke to emulation them which are of my own flesh, and might save some of them. For if the casting away of them be the reconciliation of the world, so even if you believed that the Jews were completely cast away, Paul said it would have meant the reconciliation of the entire world, what shall the receiving of them be but life from the dead? And how do you determine righteousness according to chapter 1? Resurrection from the dead. Paul's a crafty fellow, folks. He then says, for if the first fruit be holy, the lump is holy, and if the root be holy, so are the branches. You see, they were trying to break this down as to who was in, who was out, who was holy, who wasn't holy. And Paul just said, you know, hey, you know, if God's holy, if Jesus is holy, the branches are holy, the root's holy, tree's holy, branches are holy. And if some of the branches be broken off, he didn't say when the branches are broken off. He said, if some of the branches are broken off, and thou being a wild tree, he's speaking to the Gentiles, were grafted in among them, and with them partakest of the root and the fatness of the olive tree, boast not against the branches. But if thou boast, thou bearest not the root, but the root thee. And what was their boast? We have believed in our hearts and confessed with our mouths. That's what they were boasting about. Same thing Christianity boasts about to this very day, ignoring the power of the completed work of the cross. Thou will say then. Who will say then? It's not Paul saying. Thou will say then, the branches were broken off that I might be grafted in. Well, because of unbelief, they were broken off. And you stand by faith. Be not high-minded, but fear. Folks, if this is by your faith, you need to live in fear all the time. How many of you lived in that fear when it was by your faith? This is just the natural outcome of thinking that personal faith is what brings you redemption and salvation with God. For if God spared not the natural branch, take heed lest he spare not thee. Man. You see, they're saying, well, the reason we got in is because God cut off Israel. Israel was cut off. Do you know there's no place that teaches that in the Bible? Paul is addressing a doctrine that the Gentiles had adopted to try to say, this is how we got in. We were grafted in through our own belief. And Paul is renouncing this concept of being grafted in. Because remember how Paul has taught throughout this entire book that if you are a part of the plant, you had to be in the seed before the plant or before the seed died. And now these people are talking about getting attached after the fact. Sorry, that's not the way this worked. Getting attached after the fact is not the gospel. If God didn't spare them, so in your mind, God didn't spare the Jews, his chosen ones, his predestined ones, the ones he selected himself, the ones he gave the covenant to, the ones that blah, 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 on and on and on. Paul goes into detail in Hebrews chapter 3 and 4 about their unbelief, saying, yet today, if you harden not your heart, for if Christ had given them rest, then why would he say today, if you harden not your hearts, as in the provocation? Behold, therefore, the goodness and the severity of God. On them which fail, severity. But toward thee, goodness. And if you continue in his goodness, otherwise, you're going to get cut off too. Oh, happy day. Man, I'm telling you, isn't that great confidence? They know they believe for sure God cut off the Jews. They have no natural right to this inheritance whatsoever. Zero natural right to this inheritance. Yet God cut them off. You really don't have a lot of safe ground to stand on, Gentiles. And they also, if they abide not still in unbelief, shall be grafted in. For God is able to graft them back in again. But you see, Paul is showing that they were never cut off in the first place. But let's take your mindset. God cut them off. So how are they going to get back in? If they got cut off because of unbelief and you're in because of belief, God is through belief, if he did it through belief, is able to graft them back in again because of their belief. Is that what happened? Let's continue the story. For if thou were cut out of the olive tree, which is wild by nature, and were grafted contrary to nature into the good olive tree, how much more since these, which be the natural branch, be grafted into their own olive tree. Now, this is the third thing that Paul has brought up about things that are against nature. Chapter 1, the only thing the Christian world knows is chapter 1 about things that are against nature. It's the only one they know. They don't know about chapter 2, about circumcision and uncircumcision. They don't know. They have no clue. They don't know anything about chapter 11, where he's talking about being cut off and being grafted in against the nature. For if thou were cut out of the olive tree, which is wild by nature, and were grafted contrary to nature into a good olive tree, how much more shall these which be the natural branches be grafted in to their own olive tree? For I would not, brethren, that you should be or remain ignorant of this mystery, lest you should be wise in your own conceits. Now, what did Paul just describe all of this cutting off and adding on and getting the Jews that got cut off, they got grafted in, waiting on the Jews to get grafted back in through belief. It all happened through your own faith. He called it ignorance. He said, there's a mystery you missed, lest you should be wise in your own conceit. That blindness in part happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles be come in. That's what Jesus told Peter, right? That the Gentiles had been cleansed. Verse 26, and so all of Israel shall be saved. Now, where is he getting this from? Is he saying all of Israel is going to be saved? Remember, he expressed his great concern about Israel not being saved. And man, he'd give up his own salvation to see his own countrymen saved. And so all Israel shall be saved as it is written. So shall be now goes back to the scriptures. And if it's a shall be in the scriptures, what is it after the cross? It's not a shall be anymore, is it? Because who fulfilled all of the scriptures? So is the shall be still a shall be? It's not a shall be anymore, not since Jesus came to fulfill all the law and the prophets. There shall come out of Zion a deliverer, and shall turn away ungodliness from Jacob. For this is my covenant unto them, when I shall cut them off from the natural tree. Doesn't say anything like that, does it? What was God's covenant with Israel? When I shall take away their sin. As concerning the gospel, they're enemies for your sake. But as touching the election, they are beloved for the Father's sake. For the gifts and callings of God are without repentance or change of mind. Is it possible that Israel was cut off? It is not even possible. Why? Because the gifts and callings of God are without repentance. Remember how they took this verse out of context in your church? Oh man, the gift of tongues, the gift of giving. They loved people with the gift of giving. The gifts. And boy, once you got it, even if you start sinning, God's never going to take that gift away from you. Now, they taught that he would never take away, you could still lay hands on sick people if he gave you that gift, but the gift of salvation, take it away from you in one split second. But you, as a low-down, filthy sinner in their eyes, could still go around healing people. But don't be surprised about it, because the gifts and callings of God are without repentance. Once God has given you something, he doesn't take it back. Except for salvation. The gifts and callings of God, how we use that out of context, how powerful it is, and how out of context and meaningless and neuter we made it. For as ye in times past have not believed God, yet have now obtained mercy through their unbelief. What led to mercy? Unbelief led to mercy. That's why they call it mercy, folks. Faith didn't lead to mercy. Believing didn't lead to mercy. Unbelief led to mercy. For who? How much? Paul, come on, just tell us. Is this about the Jews, about the Gentiles? Which one are you talking about? Even so have these also now not believed, that through your mercy, the mercy that you got out of their unbelief, they also may obtain mercy. For God hath concluded them all in unbelief, that he might have mercy up on all. And then Paul can't hold it back anymore. He's been writing this, laboring over this. How do I get through to these people's minds? How do I get this to the point to where that they understand this? How do I get this to the point to where that they are not struggling with their own personal faith? How do I get this to where that they know that it's not Jewish faith, it's not Gentile faith, the Jews weren't cut off, the Gentiles weren't grafted in? How do I get them to understand this? His only choice is to show them just how valuable unbelief is. For God hath concluded them all in unbelief, that he might have mercy upon all. Paul brings this teaching to a close in such a euphoric way. I'm telling you, this is what the gospel does. When you realize that it is by unbelief that we were led into the promise of God, when you begin to realize that it is by our failure, by Israel's failure, when you realize that the stumbling stone and the rock of offense and stone of stumbling wasn't Jesus, it was the law. Jesus is not a rock of offense. Jesus is not a stumbling stone to the Jews. Paul said just a few verses later, let their table become a snare to them, and let their entire system become a stumbling stone. You see, Jesus is not a stumbling stone. Jesus is a cornerstone. Jesus is a headstone. Jesus is a keystone. The Jews, you can't stumble at a keystone. How many times Paul affirmed to them that the stumbling stone was the law, the sacrifices, their entire rituals, and everything about them was a stumbling stone and a rock of offense, and that God would use these things to blind their eyes and stop their ears to the point to where they would fall flat on their faces trying to follow it. And fall they did. My favorite verses in the entire New Testament, especially of Paul's writings, and you cannot help but have this response. When you realize this magnificent gospel that is detached from personal faith, that is detached from your own obedience, detached from circumcision, detached from your own righteousness, detached from everything, that you had nothing to do with it at all, but the fact of its power still exists, and the gospel is the power of God itself. Gospel cannot redeem you, folks. It only informs you that you were redeemed. It has been one of the most foolish things that Christianity's ever done, going around saying they're sharing the gospel so people can get saved. The ones we need to be teaching it to so they can get saved is the ones who's going out trying to preach to the people they think need to get saved. Because this is a whole different animal of salvation. The people they're going to share with have already been redeemed. And let the redeemed of the Lord say so. Oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and the knowledge of God. How unsearchable are his judgments, and his ways past finding out. For who hath known the mind of the Lord, or who has been his counselor? I've met a few of them. You ever met some of God's counselors? Or who hath first given to him? This is one of those verses that caused the entire word of faith to begin to crumble in my life and in my heart and in my concepts. He says, or who has first given to him and it should be repaid unto him again. Do you know the entire Word of Faith movement is preached, whether it's praise, money, worship, service, whatever it is, you're offering this to God, so God will repay you. And Paul says, that has never once happened. No wonder Paul got into such a euphoria. He preached himself happy. Why? Why such happiness, Paul? Why are you so euphoric? Why is the fact that nobody's ever given something to God, including their faith, and God had to repay them for it? Why are you so happy about this, Paul? What is it that you've got this whole world of Roman people who have learned nothing but Peter and James's message? Why is it you're so excited that you got to share this with these people? For of him, through him, and to him are all things. To whom be glory forever and ever. Amen. And that is the completion of the teaching of Romans chapter 1 through chapter 11. You know, sometimes it's very difficult to imagine why I'm here. It's difficult for me to imagine how I got here. I obviously know the story, but it's still so out of the reach of anything that I've ever done, ever thought, ever considered that I might possibly be doing or would do or should do or could do. A man with severe social panic disorder does not go around trying to find places to go speak. Now, I'm not trying to tell you that God chose me for this. I refuse that. I refuse that as much as I refuse that it's by my faith that I've been redeemed. But am I grateful that I get to share this message? There is no way that I could possibly tell you how grateful I am that such magnificent words, such magnificent understanding, such clarity, such freedom to breathe and think. Isn't it amazing once you hear the gospel, it's just like you can take the biggest, deepest breath you've ever had in your life. You can suddenly, your mind is free to think, to conceive as to the possibilities about life and your life and what the possibility is in front of you. People that come to understand the gospel are not paralyzed by the fears that hold them back. They're paralyzed by the possibilities that are in front of them. They're so vast. They're so plentiful. They're so amazing. Don't ever close your heart or mind to the possibilities of what the future could hold for you. Because if it can be a dream, it has a possibility of happening. Don't let anybody rob you. Only you understand what you want out of this life. Nobody else knows what you want out of this life. Nobody else knows what makes you content. Nobody else on this planet knows what causes you to be able to find your greatest sense of value and worth in what you are doing. Nobody can decide that for you. Nobody can dictate that to you. Women have suffered under Christian doctrine worse than men could ever think. Guys, as much as we think that we've had it bad, the ladies in here and the women around this world have suffered under Christian doctrine and every other religion around the world. Christianity has treated them as second rate, half rate, not capable of preaching, teaching, having to live with a husband they have to obey. Paul gets such a bad rap where women are concerned. when the first person that I know of in the history of the planet that ever stood up and said, there is now, therefore, now no difference between male or female. Yet Paul gets the bad rap for being against women. Yet he was the first one to declare equality between. Very first one. I love spending my time here with you guys. Thank you so much. We're going to see if you have any questions. Maybe you've got some answers. Yes, Neil. Blessed assurance. Take off.
Blessed assurance, Jesus is mine. Oh, what a foretaste of glory divine.
What are you?
Heir of salvation.
What else?
Purchase of God.
What else?
Born of His Spirit, washed in His blood.
Whose story is that?
This is my story.
This is my song, praising my Savior all the day long. This is my story. This is my song, praising my Savior all the day long.
I've often said Jesus didn't do this for you personally, but boy, don't we take it personally. It's hard not to. Vic. Did Paul write the rest of the book? That's a really good question. I have my questions about it. The one thing that we know about all of Paul's letters is that there was an attempt to alter Paul's teachings by add-ons by writers hundreds of years later, trying to copy the style, make it look like Paul, say it was Paul. I can tell you, the only thing I can tell you for sure is this teaching on this subject ends at the end of chapter 11. You can tell it ends by the close. I mean, isn't that a close of a letter? I mean, why would you say such a thing and then say, oh yeah, and then this too? How anticlimactic could something be? Personally, the six chapters that follow, I have great doubts that Paul wrote those. I think the book of Ephesians, I think Paul wrote the first three chapters of Ephesians. I think 4, 5, and 6 was written by somebody else. Scholars really know that Paul's letters were tampered with. Do you see why they would have been tampered with? They may not, because of the way they were written, to go in. You see, nowadays we can go in and we can cut and paste and put in the middle. But see, the only thing they could do is add on to the front or the back. And when you see such a drastic change take place in the last few chapters or chapter or whatever, you really can suspect that there is a possibility of someone's tampering with this, such as 1 Timothy. 1 Timothy, the first chapter of 1 Timothy is just really Paul all the way. And then it goes into writings of stuff that it just sounds like it totally disagrees with what Paul said in the first couple of chapters of Timothy. Do I know that for a fact? I don't know it for a fact. But I do know that we have a body of work from the Apostle Paul that lets us know this magnificent gospel. And if it's not there in the rest of the letter, I just leave it alone. I've openly done that. I can tell you that there is no more teaching on this subject in those last six chapters. Did Paul write an addendum to it? I don't know. Maybe he did. But there are contradictory statements in these last six chapters of the book of Romans that sure don't look like it was Paul. There's some places it's like, yeah, that kind of sounds like Paul. And then it's, yeah, Boy, that just can't be Paul, because this disagrees directly with what he said in chapter 5 and chapter 6. You can pick those things out. It's amazing that we have to deal with such tampered with evidence. But at least we know the evidence was tampered with. So we can watch out for it. We can be aware. Now, like I said, there are people that are scholars in linguistics that go in and they see the cadence, they see the words that are used, the words, and they can tell you exact. They can show you exactly where somebody stops writing one thing and somebody else tries. Well, even if though they try very hard to mimic it, it's like a thumbprint. It's like a fingerprint. It just doesn't match up. And now I am not a trained person in this type of forensics to see whether or not the rest of the book of Romans is or is not written by Paul. I can give you a personal opinion. I don't think it was. If it was, I don't find anything in there that can possibly detract away from this marvelous teaching in chapter 1 through chapter 11. Yeah. Yeah, you're exactly right. It seems as though that, and Vic was talking to me about this just about 3 weeks ago, it seems as though that Paul and Peter and John kind of started out on the same page, or at least close to it. The influence over Paul and over Peter is very clear that James tried to influence them toward the law. Sacrifices. He told Paul he had to go in and not only go through this animal sacrifices 25 years after the cross, and James is advocating that Paul go offer animal sacrifices in the temple, and not only to offer those animal sacrifices, but to go with four other people that they already had. So this wasn't done just for Paul. People say, oh, well, now they just did this for Paul, just with Paul, so that Paul could try to prove to the Jews and Paul was becoming all that. Folks, they already had four people who were getting ready to go through this this rite. And James not only ordered Paul to go through with it, he ordered him to pay for the other four guys. Now, if you cannot see the contention, I mean, of being ordered not only to go through a spiritual rite or a animal sacrifice, a rite of cleansing, and know that Paul, number one, would have had no part of it by his own volition, but to not see the fact that he was commanded by James to pay for the other guys, there was problems here. There really was problems. The thing that we see, if Paul was able to pay for his own sacrifices and the sacrifices of four other people, he was a wealthy man. He had money. Guess who James didn't like? He didn't like people with money. It's impossible to read the book of James and not see this man did not like people that had money. It is said that he was a part of the of a sect of the Ebionites. They were a group that had a vow of poverty. If you wonder how that kind of got into religion and the Catholic Church and everything, it pretty well comes from the Ebionites, which James was. And then, now the Ebionites today, you can't prove that absolutely, but the Ebionites today claim him as the founder of their religion, as he's the head of the Ebionites. He is honored or dishonored with that title, whichever one you might say that's think it to be. So the clarity, when you try to crawl back into history and you try to stand in their shoes, it really does, it did something to me. As I began to stand there, and I've tried my best to stand in Paul's place when he was being instructed by James to go and do this sacrifice. Now, the one thing that we know, they tried to kill Paul. They caught him in the temple, and they drug him out of the temple. And it was Jews that were from Asia that had followed Paul. They had been kind of dogging his tracks. James knew this. James knew exactly what was going on. He was the head by whatever means. I mean, you will not find anything in the Bible that says why James, by the scriptures or by the New Testament, why James wound up being the head of the church in Jerusalem. There is nothing there. But become the head of it, he did. Ruling with such authority that even Paul himself submitted to it, to doing something that would have been completely against everything that was in Paul's consciousness about sacrifices and about anything to do with the law whatsoever. Then you have Peter, of course, who was influenced greatly by James, says he was influenced by James. Paul called him out on it. And Jesus himself had told Peter to that the Gentiles had all been cleansed. So Peter evidently started, as Paul told in the book of Galatians, he said, you used to go and eat with the Gentiles. Now you see, that would have been a new thing for Peter. Peter would not have been eating with the Gentiles unless something drastic had happened to him, such as Jesus appearing to him and saying, don't call unclean what I've cleansed. Now, first off, we know that Peter was willing to disobey Jesus for his religious convictions. Remember how many times he said, no, I'm not doing it, Jesus. Rise, kill, and eat. No, no, no. So we know by character that Peter was willing to disobey the risen Christ rather than to do what he said because of the oppression. And let me just say what I see. Because of the terrorism of James. I believe as much as Paul terrorized the early church, I believe that James terrorized anybody who dared to preach freedom and anything that was against the law, eating with Gentiles, against circumcision, whatever it was, he was willing to terrorize them. It says that Peter was stricken with fear of James. Absolutely stricken with fear of James. Now, here's the man who walked on water. This incredible thing going on with him and Jesus. He knew Jesus personally. And yet here James was able to strike fear in his heart about following through with what Jesus told him to do, that he ceased to eat with Gentiles anymore. And Paul rebuked him and said that you, Peter, and James are not walking uprightly according to truth. Now, the ramifications of such a harsh indictment against them is real. Do you think those guys forgot about that? Do you think that he withstood Peter to the face, told him that this man named James and John, that you used to eat with the Gentiles until the guys in Jerusalem, and he named them by name, that when men was sent from them, that's when you stopped eating with Gentiles? And it says that when Paul saw that they walked not uprightly according to the truth, he rebuked Peter before them all. Where was James? The best we can tell, James never once left Jerusalem after he took over the authority in Jerusalem. There is no historical record that he ever left Jerusalem. There's no biblical record that he ever walked out of Jerusalem one single time. When it came time for his death, to get rid of him, they had to throw him from the roof of the temple. That's how closely attached to seat of authority and power that he was, that he died there. Now, it's said that the reason that they threw him from the temple is that he would not say that Jesus Christ was not the Lord. We don't know if that story is correct or not. This is some historical account that is extra-biblical, and we do have historical accounts. We have no account of really what happened to the other disciples. You know, there was 12 disciples, folks. Do you realize the rest of them aren't even mentioned? Peter, James, and John, and that's it. But there was a mass exodus that took place out of Jerusalem when Paul was breathing out his threatenings. You've got to understand that Paul's conversion, these people had left town because of Paul's terrorism. And now all of a sudden, they've got a new terrorist in town. He is governing what people believe and can believe and can't believe based on Judaistic law. He is imposing it on Gentiles. It's just the facts. And that part we find right in here. This is not something that's hidden. It's just right there. You say, well, why haven't we ever seen this before? Because we were told it wasn't there. We were told it wasn't there. There's no disagreement in here. These guys all agreed with each other. So what happened to your brain when you read across it? You went skiing. Just shh, right over the top of it. You didn't even see it. How interesting. And you went on. But you see, we've slowed down. You know, we got off the skis and started on a nice hike up the mountain. And we've started seeing things a little bit more than skiing across the surface of this. But I'm telling you, the history of this is very much here. There's other historians existed back in that time. There's a lot of people that agree with him, a lot of people that disagree with him. But the fact that James held this position of power is recorded in history and also in the Bible. That's just all there was to it. I see no reason for someone to refuse to leave the seat of his power other than fear that he would lose his power if he left the place. Why else would you confine yourself like a prisoner and never leave the town, never leave the temple, stay there during the entire time? There was something about it that James wanted this power. He claimed the power. And for some reason, Paul and the disciples, Peter and John, and the rest of the disciples, man, they just left town. They just didn't want any part of it. Whether it was, and so when you hear, when you start reading what James had to say to the 12 tribes scattered abroad, you know what he says there? If you look at those Greek words, he's talking to the poor Jews that are scattered abroad. It is very clear that he's talking to poor Jews, not just Jews, but to the poor Jews. So who's he writing to? He's writing to his own sect. Why did this sect leave town? They left because of Paul. There's just no other reason for the scattering other than Paul's breathing out his threatenings. Did James have a willing audience about his statements that he wanted to have Paul? Did he have to say the name of Paul for these people to know who the hell he was talking about? Isn't it rich people that oppress you and take you before the Sanhedrin? Well, just how many of those was there around? There's only one recorded in the New Testament, and that was Paul. Every chance in the book of James. I tell you what, if you read the book of James and just allow yourself to think he might have been talking about Paul, it's going to jump out at you as clear as day. This man did not like people that had money. James believed that while he was living in the opulence of the temple, he taught that poverty was righteousness. James taught that wealth is unrighteousness. How the Word of Faith movement can quote anything out of the book of James, I don't know how they do it. Because James totally believed if you got money, you're ungodly. It's what he taught, it's what he believed, it's what he lived, except for the opulence of the temple he occupied. Any other questions? The best we understand is this is what the group was called before the term Christian was attached. All right? It was called the People of the Way at first. But now you see the People of the Way, just the same as the term Christian, was ascribed by other people. They didn't say, oh, we are people of the way. It was unbelievers that called them people of the way. It was other people that called them, that made the statements to them that, that's those Christians, which has become a curse word, folks. So here we are trying to figure out what is a Christian. Well, if we're all Christians, what is a Christian? So you look up the word and it says to be Christ-like. So then what do? We teach entire churches full of people to be Christ-like. WWJD. Who wants Jack Daniels? WWJD. I like it too. We do know that Christianity was Christian was not a name that Jesus called them. Jesus never called people to be Christians. Paul never called people to be Christians. He never even called them to become people of the way. None of that ever took place out of Paul's mouth. The term Christian is used by only one of the New Testament writers, where I believe it's Peter who says, but if any man suffer as a Christian, you know, that's all right. You know, you shouldn't go around suffering, but if you suffer as a Christian, that's an acceptable type of suffering if you're suffering for being Christian. Now, we don't know that that's just the name that he finally accepted, that this is what they call us. But there is nothing biblical, there is nothing scriptural about why people began to be called Christians or should be called Christians today. We know that the definition of the word has led people into a lot of very deep bondage, for sure, trying to be Christ-like. The only thing we have to rely on, Owen, is people like this, because they're not a part of Christianity. Now, you've got to realize, I never told anyone in this room to stop being a Christian. I never told anybody in this room to stop going to church. Is that a true statement, guys? I have never given you an instruction to stop doing, stop going, stop doing, stop anything. I've never told you to stop anything. We just simply shared the gospel with them. Now, what has happened to them, I think, is the pattern of what you're asking. The only thing that we have, the gospel, is the power of God. Why would we want to use some other force, you know? So the issue is just simply getting it to the ears of the people that need to hear it. Thus, walk in Owen. Everybody else who does. Thus, walk in Wade Brewer, who goes into mosque and every place that he can go. I mean, if he's painting a house and somebody's painting with him, he's going to know the gospel by the time the house is painted. It's just Wade Brewer. That's all there is to it. Now, let me tell you, with me, people that are around me on a daily basis, now, Owen knows this. Owen's around me every day. We go to the gym, and Owen knows nobody around me knows what I do whatsoever. Well, Mike, shouldn't you be? I don't go with shouldn't you be and all of that. Now, if Wade ever needs any money to keep doing what he's doing, I'll send him a check to help him do it. I ain't doing it. Why? I don't want to do it. This is what I like to do. This is what I want to do, and this is how I do it. I do not tell people that I'm in. I very rarely tell somebody I'm in the ministry. Owen can tell you himself, he had to drag it out of me what I do. After 6 or 7 times into the restaurant, he just pinned me down. And he said, Mike, tell me what you do. And I know he noticed the hesitance. And I said, okay, I'll give you the 2-minute Reader's Digest version. Because all I want to do is get on the other side of it, forget it, and let's keep going. I'm not out to convert people. And I gave him the 2-minute Reader's Digest version, and I hadn't been able to get rid of him since. So, and I'm glad I'm not able to get rid of him also. But folks, you got to follow your own heart. This is not a prescription for how we do this. You follow your heart. If you want to share with people, if you want to go and sit down and talk to pastors, if you want to do this on the job, if you don't want to do it on the job, you see, that's the wonderful thing about the gospel. We don't have any instructions for you whatsoever. We don't have any. This is not how you do it, when you do it, where you do it. We just don't have any of those instructions. Am I right by doing that? It's not an issue of whether I'm right or wrong. It's just me. I have found power in just knowing the gospel truth. It has, oh my gosh. I don't ever want somebody to connect doing something with being who they are. Once you get your being down and you know there is nothing that challenges your being, whether you do or don't do, whatever it is, then decide what you want to do. Many of you here, your number one way of supporting the gospel and making sure the gospel gets out is that you give us money when we come up here. And we really do appreciate that. Also, I've been needing to tell you, if anybody wants to help out Moses and his family in Kenya, please designate that to Vic. These guys still have the Schools of the Scriptures going over there. They've been through some really hard times. I am so sorry that I did not bring that up earlier. But anything that you would decide, if you want to give them $25 or $50, $100 or $10,000, it's fine with me. But they definitely could use the help. They are doing a lot to spread the gospel in the middle of great, great hardship. That is for sure. Satisfy you?
I'm satisfied.
All right. Who else? Anybody got just a comment? This is it. Yes. Oh, I think so, hon. You know, my brother, it's been difficult. We've had a strained relationship, possibly just perception on my part. I don't know. He's been a Baptist ever since he came to the Lord when he was standing in a hospital room and I had just attempted suicide. And I came to, and I was just a kid, and I came to, and Gary just swore I'd never known him to be in a church. He never went to church. And so I came to, I've been told all this because I don't remember these things. I was unconscious for 3 days from a suicide overdose. And but I came to, Gary came in the room, and I came to, in the moment he was there, and I looked up at him. I reached my hand out to him, and he took my hand, and I said, "Gary, please pray for me." And that's all I said. Now, my family told me that he slid down the wall, really unable to stand. And he told his wife they needed to leave. He went home. I think this was on a Saturday. They were there. He said, "Tomorrow morning we're going to church." And before the pastor could give the altar call, he was up running toward the front. My brother's a good man. He wanted to help me more than anything. He has been a dedicated, committed person to his Christianity. You will not find a better human being. Honestly, he is just a wonderful man. He's 77 years old. He's 11 years older than I. And then there's four sisters in between us, and all crazy as they can be. They're my sisters. How else could they be anything else? Gary's just a very solid, dependable, stable man. Worked at Y-12 there at in Oak Ridge. At the atomic energy place. He retired from working at Y-12. And I've always been proud of my brother. You know, my brother, I was really stupid in school, you know. And my brother took calculus and trigonometry and all this stuff. And he's a basketball player. And he was a golfer. And he wore classy clothes with pleats down the front, you know. And they just buzzed my hair off and put me in a pair of jeans, you know. And that's my story. That's the way I remember it. I'm sure others have a different story. But recently, Gary has been watching our Tuesday night Bible studies. Blew me away. I went up to see my sister, and who's not been feeling well, and her husband died. I went up just a month or so ago, month and a half or so ago, and she and my brother was just, it was amazing. I just could not believe what was happening. And then after that's when he told me that he had been watching these Tuesday night Bible studies. Folks, if you're not watching that, you are missing something. This is 15 minutes of power-packed. I mean, I played the song for you. Now you know why we're so jazzed up when we come online. We play Uptown Funk, and we play that right before we go on the air, and sometimes we barely get it turned off before we go live. So if you hear the tail end of Uptown Funk, you'll know what's going on. But my brother brought up the conversation when I was up the last time, and then he talked to me again about it on the phone. And I told him, you know, I'm trying to be gracious and say this to where that he'll keep listening, and I'm so glad that he's listening. I want him to have all the truth he can have. If he's happy where he is, then I want him to stay there. I don't want to try to change my brother. He's a wonderful man. And so I was telling him, I said, Gary, I said, you know, I don't know for sure that what I'm teaching is absolute truth or not. I said, I'm really just trying to follow my heart, I've seen people really helped by this, but I said history and other people will have to judge my work for what I've done, and they'll have to decide whether or not what I've done has been a good thing or not. And he said, well, he said, I can tell you one thing, it's been good for you. So here, without to address your point, I'm sorry to tell such a long story to get to a single little point. I didn't have to tell my brother anything. And he said, Mike, he says, when you were up here, said the whole family was talking about it. They said, we see that you have the peace that we all hoped that you might have someday. I mean, you know, they went through 3 attempts at suicide with me. They never knew when the phone was going to ring and I was going to be dead. So this is what my relationship to my family was early on. And, you know, we'd lost our mother when I was 14 years old. So everybody was traumatized by that. And then they went right into me, you know, every whip stitch, taking an overdose. And and I joined churches. I'd be baptized again. I got baptized again. After I got my brother to go to church, I went to his church and got saved in his church. And then I got baptized in his church. And I remember my brother, he got so tickled because the pastor was trying to figure out how the hell to baptize me with me being as tall as I am. And he was kind of a little guy. And when he took me, it was one of those Baptist churches with, you know, the window and the baptistries up behind the choir. And when he tried to get me, he told me, he whispered to me, he says, Mike says, when I get ready to take you down, squat down. Because he was trying to figure out how to do this. And even after I squatted down, he dunked me and knocked my head into the concrete on the edge of the... And so I really almost died with Christ right there, going under the water. And I remember my brother getting so tickled. He's got a very distinctive laugh. And I could just hear him chuckling out there. He just got so tickled that the pastor just about knocked me out trying to baptize me. So you just don't know where life's going to go. I thought that I'd lost my... I thought that I had lost my family forever. And that's just something that I had to live with. So the possibility, even a possibility... is just so amazing to me. At the same time, you know, you got to protect your heart a little bit because you can't just open up totally because, you know, they could walk right out of your life again just like it seemed like before. Just let people see see what the gospel is. Let them see what it is. They don't have to hear what it is. Let's let them see what it is. Any other comments? Anything anybody wants to say? Oh, if they ask me directly, I tell them that I do not espouse to Christianity. But I right behind that, I let them know. I said I have a very strong persuasion about Christ and what he did, and I just don't think Christianity is a good representative. Now, usually when I say that, people are very open to that. Most people are really kind of burnt out on Christianity, even if they're still going. But you got to say it in a way to where that they can hear it. You got to make sure that they know that you're respect and you're convinced of who Jesus is, but you just think that Christianity is not representing the gospel in a way. And I said, I kind of left Christianity, but it has nothing to do with leaving Christ. I said, I'm still completely all in for Jesus. No, I'm giving them a term they are unfamiliar. They would not be familiar with. Now, we that term redemptionist is a word that is created by Mike Williams Ministries in the Gospel Revolution. We were talking about, people are going to label us, so why don't we come up with a term that labels ourselves? We are not universalists, so what do we call ourselves? So I think it was Jeff Robertson, actually, that was, we were sifting through words and how to say this and everything, and Jeff, I think it was, found that there was no claim to the word redemptionist or redemptionism. And so we thought, hey, we'll claim it. That kind of sounds like what we do. So down through the ages, if somebody is Googling redemptionist, it's going to have one definition, and we have put the definition as to what a redemptionist is and what they believe, or what we believe. So we had folks that got upset that we added an ism to it. Oh, isms are schisms, and I don't know why you had to do this. Why didn't we just stay free from all that? Well, we're just trying to reach out every way we can, We don't have a way to do it and a way not to do it. We just try everything we can. We'll throw the spaghetti at the refrigerator and see if it sticks, Thank you guys for this time.